Welcome to the Geneva Peace Week podcast series, a project of the Geneva Peacebuilding Platform. Geneva Peace Week was founded on the core belief that each person, actor, and institution has a role to play in building peace and resolving conflict. Geneva Peace Week is an annual forum in the peacebuilding calendar that includes ceremonies, high-level panels, policy briefings, workshops, videos, podcasts, and other special events. These free contributions are hosted by different organizations and actors around the world. This year, Geneva Peace Week celebrates its 10th anniversary and is held from the 30th of October to the 3rd of November, 2023. For more content, join us at the Geneva Peace Week or online at www.genevapeaceweek.ch.
Everyone, I'm Mariana from Control Arms, and this is the third episode of our podcast series unveiling the impact of arms control, real-world insights. In this episode, we are trying to answer an interesting, important, and challenging question. We want to unravel what needs to happen at the transnational and multilateral level to deliver impactful change at the country level, and ultimately ensure that arms control agreements contribute actively, promoting peace, stability, and security. We will talk about this with today's speakers, who are Montserrat Martinez, who is a research consultant specialized on gender and armed violence, Shirin Yurdi, member of the International Board of Control Arms, and Karina Solmirano, who is the project lead of the ATT Monitor. With this lineup in mind, I would like to turn to our first speaker, Montserrat. What do you think needs to happen at the multilateral level to deliver change at the country and international levels?
I have a two-part answer on this question. The first is that it depends a bit of the on the region of the world you are in, and within the same region, context matters. For instance, whether it is a situation of widespread armed violence or criminal violence, and even within those categories, there is a spectrum of realities that do not have like clear definitions. So I will briefly refer to a complex reality in Mexico. On one hand, there are studies that indicate that the perception of insecurity has generated a greater acquisition of weapons by households. If to this we add that there is a discrepancy between the number of registered weapons legally and the number that people admit to have been acquired during 2012 and 2019, and also in addition to this, we have the situation of gender violence against women in Mexico, which seems to be like an important phenomenon to study. And there, because there is a major crisis of homicides and femicides of women, and multiple daily and widespread violence against women. So what we find under these circumstances, what we are finding in the currently is that the proportion of women who are injured or killed with firearms in the street is increasing. So it's kind of a different phenomenon that what has been studied and what we've been registering of the like firearms kill women in their houses and the causes of what women are being killed by firearms. So the question here that raises under these circumstances is, do the women feel safer or less safer than before, under knowing that nowadays we have this international regime on arms control? And on the other hand, I would like to refer to this question about that it has to do with the fact that this international gun control regime has allowed people to develop their capacity for agency, not only as victims, but also for them to start seeking to understand other contexts and trying to provide solutions that adapt to the reality. So that's why I wanted to answer this question in two parts, because sometimes in reality we are facing like more challenges that we never expected to raise in the way they have developed until these days. And on the other hand, we see like this active participation by citizens on a daily basis, that they want to be engaged on these dynamics and they want to to states be accountable for what they are doing on these matters to really address their security and their safety and the safety of their families. So I think like, we have like, still there are challenges on these matters, but at least we have something to rely upon.
Thank you, Montserrat. And this was definitely a tough question to answer. And what do you think, Shireen?
Yeah, especially lately now, we have seen lots of discussion around feminist foreign policy. And we have seen the linkages. And I think this is one thing that we need to take into account. We need to move away from silos. We need to see how to mainstream different agendas to enhance one another, because I think this silos is what brings down the effectiveness of implementations of different agendas. So I think for the feminist foreign policy, this has to be one of the things to see what are the root causes of conflict. And definitely arms is one of the root causes of conflict. You can have a certain mindset, just like as we say in the Arab region, maybe we have a certain mindset that a culture of peace for individual is not yet really accomplished. So if there's a lack of a culture of peace in the mindset of people and weapons, then definitely it's going to lead to killing. And this is where we need to see also how the feminist foreign policy is approaching the issue of armament and exportation of arms. Another thing that I see is that how we can include a localization approach to the Women, Peace and Security Agenda, the Youth, Peace and Security Agenda, how we can include it in the DDR discussions, how we can enhance it in terms to say that the way of transformation of conflict, the way of the dynamics of conflicts, we need to see where are the arms. Where are the arms? And as Will says, where is the money and where are the arms? So this is where you see the conflict. A strong engagement of civil society, advocating and monitoring implementation is another thing. And I think in a way or another, we need to really effectively see what are the different components of the conflict. Networking definitely is one thing that I see as well. Accountability is one of things. At times, I usually in the feminist circles, what I usually endorse for is that we are overwhelmed in conflict areas with our conflict. It's not only a conflict, meaning the usage of weapons, but at times, even like we have challenges with electricity, with water, with financial things, and we are overwhelmed with our conflicts. Our state of mind, we're not well. At times we are referred to as being resilient, a terminology that I refuse to have. I do not want to be resilient. I want to live in peace. So just as this is happening, we need also feminist organizations, peace building organizations, control arms organizations to be our voices when we cannot, to call the accountability of their governments, of their states, just like as, like I know for a fact, our colleague in Control Arms, what they have done in the UK, how they have made the, how they have stopped shipments of armaments. Our also like colleagues in Italy, how they stopped armaments into Yemen. So we as civil society, we have a role to play. As civil society, we have now social media, which is available to us. So maybe we need to make use out of social media, maybe to have a certain hashtag where we can lobby everyone into this process. And we need also to stop our governments from the production, from the selling, because after all, this is an economic thing for the governments that is leading to bloodshed in our region.
Thank you, Shireen. This insight is extremely important for us. And Karina, welcome back. What do you think about this matter? What do you think that needs to change at the multilateral and international level to deliver change at the country and international level?
Again, in my experience, although we have these examples that I mentioned of, you know, positive cooperation between countries, I still think that there are certain deficits in terms of interagency cooperation. This is a big one. This is something that it's very mentioned most of the time. You know, customs not knowing how to implement certain instruments in their border areas, police officers without the jurisdictional duties, you know, to do certain things to stop illicit trafficking or to, you know, inform cases of diversion. And I think there's also cases where the lack of resources, and especially in terms of technology, you know, has an impact. You know, you would be surprised to know how many countries still record, you know, on paper. And so when you don't have centralized databases, you know, to share cases of diversion, to share cases of suspect, you know, gun trafficking, it's very difficult to make these implementations. There is a political will in the region, and this is a region where we have really tight gun regulations, which is really interesting. And at the same time, you see the struggle that sometimes comes, you know, across these different agencies, especially in places where we have federal systems, meaning, you know, you have decentralized police authorities, decentralized systems, administrative systems, judiciary systems. So I think that's a big challenge for our region. But I can see that there are, you know, promising examples, especially in places. Well, I would mention, you know, in the case of Argentina, where over the past decade or so, there has been a program, a disarmament program that has been approved by the Congress, by which, you know, people can go and surrender their old weapons. You know, these weapons are then destroyed. This is an effort that has been also supported by civil society in Argentina, and civil society has been at the forefront of pushing for this disarmament law. And a similar case has been the disarmament law in Brazil that was pushed back in the day by civil society organizations. So the examples are there. It's just that sometimes civil society and the administrations don't talk to each other, but the expertise is there. So I would encourage more governments in our region to count on those resources, to count on the expertise and the institutional expertise that civil society has, you know, in relation to this, how to implement certain aspects of these multilateral agreements.
Thank you, Karina. This is an incredibly important insight from your perspective. We are now approaching the end of the episode and of the whole podcast series. I would like to leave the floor to Hina Wailuz. The floor is yours.
Oh, well, thanks very much, Mariana. My name is Hina Wailuz, and I am the Interim Director of Control Arms. I wish to express my deep appreciation to the Control Arms Coalition members that took the time to contribute their personal experiences, insights, and expertise to this podcast. To Karina, Baptiste, Edward, Montserrat, Pauline, and Shireen, thank you very much for your time and valuable inputs. Control Arms works to prevent the suffering caused by irresponsible conventional arms transfers. But equally important is to ensure that the voices of civil society are heard and inform work at the multilateral level. If multilateral agreements are to be effective, then they must be informed by the realities confronted by those working on the ground towards their implementation. As we have heard in this podcast, it is conventional weapons and especially guns which each and every day impact on the lives of too many people around the world. This podcast only gives a brief glimpse into the views of how a small number of Control Arms members view multilateral agreements such as the Arms Trade Treaty and UN Programme of Action on Small Arms and Light Weapons. Multilateral agreements can be powerful tools for bringing about change and addressing global issues, but their success relies on continuous efforts to measure their impact, understand and work to resolve implementation challenges, and provide the necessary support to turn their goals into reality. Next year, in 2024, Control Arms will celebrate 10 years of the entry into force of the Arms Trade Treaty. In doing so, we will be reflecting on whether the ATT has played a role in preventing violations of human rights and international humanitarian law, and asking the question, if not, why is this the case? In doing this, we will continue to work with all Control Arms Coalition members from around the world. Finally, I wish to thank my colleague Mariana Campaldini for her outstanding efforts to bring this podcast together, and to my former colleague Helena Bowser, who bravely led the way in getting this podcast started. Thanks once again to everyone for tuning into this podcast, and we look forward to your joining future Control Arms events.
You've been listening to the Geneva Peace Week podcast series. For more content like this, join us at the Geneva Peace Week or online at www.genevapeaceweek.ch.